The headlines, tensions flare up as Israeli forces break in Tal Afsa Mosque and make way for settlers to enter the holy site. A report says the United States has provided intelligence that helped Ukrainian armed forces kill several Russian generals. And voters across the UK head to the polls to elect their new local representatives, with a recent survey predicting huge losses for the Conservative Party. Hello and welcome, everybody. Israeli forces have attacked Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque to make way for settlers to enter the holy site in occupied Al-Quds City. A number of Palestinians were injured as Israeli forces fired rubber bullets and tear gas. Israeli troops have on various occasions attacked Palestinians at Al-Aqsa over the past several weeks. That comes despite repeated warnings by Palestinians urging the regime to stop desecrating the holy site. Resistance movement Hamas has reacted to the latest Israeli attack, calling it a serious escalation and direct provocation. Islamic Jihad also said all those gathering at Al-Aqsa to defend it are supported by resistance groups. The Fatah Party reacted as well. It promised a firm response to occupiers and called on all Palestinians to converge on Al-Aqsa. We've reached out to our correspondent in the occupied West Bank, Mona Kandil, to get more details about the latest Israeli raid on Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Israeli settlers raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex this morning under the protection of Israeli forces, of course, while hundreds of Palestinian Muslim worshippers were inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque and its complex in order to prevent this raid by the settlers. However, they were locked down in the Qibli Mosque and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, as well as the complex of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and Israeli forces opened rubber-coated bullets towards them and also fired the stun grenades and tear gas canisters in order to force them out of the Muslim holy site and allow the settlers to enter. The something that is very provocative and considered as desecration of the Muslim holy site is that we are receiving now settlers held and raised the Israeli flag inside the complex of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinians are saying today they don't want to hear more condemnations. What they really want is actions on ground. They want the international community to move, to impose sanctions on the Israeli regime.
Historian and journalist Breck Yonker says some Muslim countries have unfortunately been enticed by Israeli money in recent years and ignored the Palestinian cause.
More and more Arab League countries specifically, and unfortunately Muslim countries in general, there are more and more of these regimes, of these governments that have been enticed by the prospect of basically Zionist funds, Zionist money, and the direct material and financial benefits of doing business with the Zionist entity and of recognizing the Zionist entity, and have de facto been bribed out of supporting the Palestinian cause. Now, honesty requires us to admit that a lot of these countries have only been really supporting Palestine in words and not in deeds for already a long time. Specifically, of course, some of the Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia and the UAE and Bahrain, even if they, until a few years ago, were to support Palestine by word of mouth, they never really did anything to support them. But now we see that since 2020, specifically, some of these countries, some of these governments have openly gone over to the other side and have started blatantly collaborating with the Zionist entity. And that's specifically the case in the UAE and in Bahrain and in countries like Morocco as well. And this is a very, very deplorable situation, because indeed these people, these leaders, these rulers still claim to be self-professed Muslims. And as such, when an attack is taking place against the sanctuary, against the Al-Aqsa compound, this is an attack against all of Islam and an attack against all Muslims worldwide.
Administrative detention is an illegal practice that Israel uses extensively and routinely, told Palestinians. The incarceration has no time limit, and the charges, if any, are never disclosed. The number of Palestinians held under this measure has hit a record high since 2016, but the international community is keeping silent on administrative detention, as it does with the other apartheid practices of the Tel Aviv regime. And this is seen as a green light for Israel to continue its illegal occupation and violation of Palestinians' rights.
An Israeli rights group has shed light on the regime's brutal behavior towards Palestinians. According to Hamoked, Israel is holding 604 detainees without charge or trial. Nearly all the detainees are Palestinian. The Israeli regime rarely uses administrative detention against Jews. The last time Israel held this many administrative detainees was in October 2016. Back then, the regime's illegal settlement expansion plan sparked a wave of anger and frustration amongst Palestinians. Administrative detainees are arrested on, quote, secret evidence. They are unaware of the accusations against them and are not allowed to defend themselves in court.
In the past several weeks, we've seen an escalation in ongoing Zionist attacks, invasions of Al-Aqsa Mosque and many areas in Jerusalem. We've seen repeated invasions of Jenin. We've seen ongoing attacks on demonstrations, on Palestinians defending their land. And that's really in Palestine from the river to the sea. And in many of these cases, these attacks have been accompanied by the mass detention and arrests of Palestinians.
The detainees are usually held for renewable six-month periods that often lead to years in detention. Israel claims the procedure allows authorities to hold suspects while continuing to gather evidence. But critics and rights groups say the system is widely abused and denies due process. Several Palestinians in administrative detention have gone on prolonged hunger strikes in protest, while many developing lifelong health issues. Administrative detainees and their lawyers have boycotted Israeli military court proceedings since the start of this year in protest, and the courts are holding hearings without them. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for up to 11 years.
And even though the Israeli occupation's illegitimate military courts convict Palestinians over 99% of the time, they don't even have to do that. Instead, simply by issuing a military order, they can throw any Palestinian behind bars without charge or trial for up to 6 months at a time in a way that's indefinitely renewable. And this is what Israeli administrative...
Currently, more than 2,400 Palestinians are serving sentences after being convicted in Israel's military courts, and close to 1,500 others are being held for questioning, awaiting trial, or are being tried. Meantime, Israel has detained more than 9,000 Palestinian children across the occupied territories over the past 7 years.
According to Israeli rights groups, 2,441 Palestinians are currently serving sentences after being convicted in Israel's military courts. A further 1,478 detainees are being held for questioning, have been charged and are awaiting trial, or are currently being tried. Last month, the Palestinian Prisoners Society, or the PPS, said the Israeli regime has detained more than 9,000 Palestinian children across the occupied territories over the past 7 years. Palestinian authorities say 1,500 Palestinian children were killed by Israeli forces during the time span beginning at the outbreak of the Second Intifada in September 2000 up to April 2013. That's the equivalent of one Palestinian child killed every 3 days for about 13 years.
Well, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that's quite clear is that the so-called, you know, security domination of the Israeli occupation is very fragile. And in reality, the Palestinian resistance is exposing that on a daily basis. But that resistance is also taking place inside the prisons as well. Every single one of these over 600 Palestinians jailed without charge or trial under administrative detention are currently engaged in a collective boycott of the military courts to demand that this illegal system, an illegitimate system, come to an immediate end.
The Palestinian Prisoners Center for Studies, or the PCBS, said in a report in September last year that Israeli authorities had clearly escalated targeting Palestinian children. Systematic torture, harassment, and repression are all examples of the fashion in which the Israeli prison authorities treat Palestinian prisoners. The Israeli prison service keeps the prisoners under deplorable conditions, lacking proper hygienic standards. Human rights organizations say Israel violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Geneva Convention. Israel has for years held Palestinians in overcrowded prisons with poor hygiene standards.
The family of Iranian citizen Hamid Nouri, currently facing trial in Sweden, has faced daily abuse and harassment from supporters of an anti-Iran terrorist group while attending court sessions in Sweden. Nouri is accused of human rights abuses. His family denies all allegations and says he has been mistreated in custody in Sweden. Robert Carter reports.
The family of an Iranian citizen on trial in Sweden has released shocking allegations of mistreatment as they continue to fight a lengthy legal battle for his release. Hamid Nouri was arrested at Stockholm Airport in 2019. Charges brought against him include human rights abuses against prisoners dating back to 1988. Nouri's wife told Press TV that he'd been held in solitary confinement, physically assaulted by prison staff, and subjected to mental torture. Nouri and his family deny all allegations. His detention has been branded illegal by Tehran.
Not only has the trial been condemned by Iranian authorities as unlawful, but also the treatment of the family of the accused. Shocking footage of Nouri's family being harassed has deepened Iranian anger at the Swedish authorities for their poor handling of the case.
Nouri's family have been in and out of court all week. Every time they arrive, supporters of a notorious anti-Iran terror group, MKO, harass and threaten them. The Swedish authorities are slow to respond. Away from the protesters, V spoke to a local Iranian eyewitness who saw this disgraceful behaviour.
It was just really, really sad for me to see an old woman walking up to the stairs to the court and hearing a bunch of words, which actually I'm ashamed even to think about it, not even bring it to my mouth, to even think about it. But this group are known, as I said. We know those people exactly how they are. We know those people from the time which they was killing Iranian soldiers during the war with Iraq. We know those people when they was, I would love to say, leaking Saudi regime's shoes for getting a bunch of dollar or money or whatever, or support from a terrorist regime, as American regime. I really would like to know what's going on for about Sweden, actually. Sweden, a country which always talk about human rights and freedom and democracy, now are supporting and making a favor and show for a group which they have been in years in a terrorist list for whole world, international terrorist list.
The accusations against Nouri are mostly taken from members of this same group. The MKO has been accused of fabricating atrocities multiple times, again raising questions about the credibility of the prosecution, who wished to see Nouri sentenced to life. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
Reports indicate that intelligence provided by the United States has helped the Ukrainian military target Russian generals during the Ukraine war. Nearly a dozen Russian generals have been killed since the war began on February 24th. That's according to the New York Times, citing multiple senior U.S. officials. The Daily says many of those generals were targeted with the help of U.S. intelligence. The report says other Western intelligence services also provided assistance in that regard. The U.S. National Security Council has denounced the claim as irresponsible. It said the U.S. only provides battlefield intelligence to help the Ukrainians defend their country. Western officials have attributed the Russian generals' deaths to low morale as well as potential communications and logistics issues. A three-day ceasefire in the Russian-held city of Mariupol, southern Ukraine, has come into effect. The truce began at 500 GMT on Thursday. It was announced by Russia a day earlier. A humanitarian corridor is also open to evacuate civilians from the site of the Azovstal steel plant. Moscow says civilians sheltering there are allowed to travel to Russia or Ukraine-controlled territory. The plant is the last stronghold of Ukrainian forces in the port city of Mariupol. Russia took control of the city last month. Lawmakers warn of dire social consequences for EU citizens after the European Commission proposes to ban Russian oil imports. The 27-nation EU is already enduring record high inflation and energy prices. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Hundreds of civil servants inside the European Commission are working on a sixth round of sanctions against Moscow over the conflict in Ukraine. More Russian individuals, banks and media outlets are being targeted. There is also a proposal to completely stop the importation of Russian oil into the 27-country EU. Legislators say the measures will not only hurt Russia.
They will also affect the lives of European citizens with a direct impact on their homes, their jobs, their wallets.
A debate on Wednesday in the European Parliament heard that inflation in the EU is eating up wages and pensions. Apparently 36 million people in the bloc are unable to sufficiently heat their homes.
We should not talk about energy poverty anymore. We are talking about actual poverty. People who cannot pay their bills anymore. And therefore, my proposal is to organise a social summit.
The new social crisis and Ukrainian refugee crisis are placing additional pressures on EU health systems, including mental health services. Those working in the sector say there is not enough financial support from governments.
I have a lot of colleagues, they are leaving, they don't want to work as a nurse anymore because the pressure is too high. And because if you have a lot of people inside the houses that cannot pay the rent, they cannot afford to pay food, they cannot pay the gas and electricity, of course, they are going to have mental issues.
Pope Francis says NATO's, quote, barking at Russia's door may have caused the conflict in Ukraine. Some EU lawmakers agree and suggest Washington is mostly to blame.
The US needs the war to reinforce the unipolar power, while Ukraine, the people of Europe, and hundreds of millions in the global south will pay the price.
The European Commission's latest sanctions on Russia are presently just proposals.
Ban all Russian oil.
Hungary and Slovakia look set to veto the oil ban. There is growing concern surrounding how the Kremlin might respond to such a ban.
That's because Russia's gas is even more important to the EU's economy than its oil. Economists say if Moscow was to switch off the gas immediately, it would be game over for the European Union. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Whose Streets, directed by Saba Folayan and Damon Davis. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Lee Jasper, who is a former policing director for London and social justice campaigner. He is also a Black Sox sponsor, which was formed in 2015 as a result of events concerning the increasing levels of violence impacting London's black communities. Now, Whose Streets is an unflinching look at the Ferguson uprising in the US state of Missouri. The uprising sparked nationwide protests the day after the fatal shooting of Michael Brown by white police officer Darren Wilson on August 9, 2014. Now, filmed on the front line of the clashes, this documentary captures the explosions, the tear gas, and the military-style police vehicles up close. And at the same time, the film also manages to show the anger and sense of outrage that the heavy-handed response provoked.
Anybody growing up here, you tangibly know when you cross the county line, you got to drive a little differently. Your behavior changes because you know how policing changes.
Ferguson police just killed a man in front of my apartment.
People flooded in the area have some experience with police.
Things have never been right for black folks in America.
We're trying to mourn, and you came here with 300 cop cars, right here in canine units.
You gonna shoot me too?
But that ain't the story that you hear about.
This movement was born in love.
We are raising activists. If there's going to be any change, it starts with our children.
This is going to be my fighter right here. Come here. Come on. Come on. Fight.
Well, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary provides a really great insight into the racial tensions of the black community in Ferguson and the police and the issue of police brutality is brought up. And we also get incredible access of the residents themselves who express their struggle from their point of view. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on Whose Streets?
The film is very specifically about Ferguson. It's not a general film about policing in America or Black Lives Matter or any of the bigger issues. It's very, very specifically about Ferguson. It does obviously touch on much bigger issues as a result. So it feels like a really important document, but it's not as easy to watch as a film. It doesn't have a central narrative line. It has a lot of great characters in it, people that it explores. Mm-hmm. But the thing that makes it really, really worth watching is the footage in it. It's full of incredibly shot footage on people's phones and their own private cameras right on the streets in the middle of all of these riots and all of the tensions and the back and forth of everything going on. So it's showing us a side of the story that the media never showed, because mm-hmm. the media kind of took a very slanted view of this whole thing. And
the documentary highlights this.
The documentary contrasts the footage that was shot in the streets with what the media showed the public, and that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes the film definitely worth seeing.
So as Rich was saying, it is an incredibly big topic with lots of layers, especially on the issue of racism, police brutality, and American gun violence, and so forth. Lee, if I could turn to you now, what's your take on these sorts of films, and why are they important?
I think it's an important part of documentation of the struggle of ordinary communities against excessive police violence and institutionalized racism. And that part, you know, it forms an essential documentary narrative around detailing their particular stories from a human perspective. Each individual family is looked at and goes into some detail. So it really gives you the full 3D picture of what a community under pressure from police racism and violence looks like, feels like, smells like, how they respond personally, how it affects their personal lives and the communities around them. And for that, I think it's an important part of social documentary.
But as Rich was saying, this documentary largely focuses on Ferguson. Mm. But as we know, the African-American community have been plagued by police brutality for decades. Mm. But what is it that made the Ferguson uprising so different?
I think it's a combination of things, really. I think that by the time 2014 comes along and the impact on new technology, on people's understanding of justice and struggle, and the extent to which we now see people capturing inappropriate policing incidents on their own mobile phones, gives this a unique feel. Because it's from 1,001 different perspectives. If anything, this film is almost like a people's film made up of huge numbers of individual filmmakers who captured various scenes, and they've tried to knit it together in the way that has been described. So I think new technology, I think Hands Up, Don't Shoot, and the Black Lives Matter are all emanated from it. I think people were tired of an Obama rhetoric which was about equality but seemed very little in terms of holding police to be accountable at a local level. And the images themselves were so deeply resonant of the black experience and the African-American experience in the United States as to sort of re-excite an embryonic civil rights movement. The scenes we saw on black and white and colour pictures of police brutality and victims in Ferguson in 2014 could have been Ferguson 1964. Yeah. And that was the power of their message.
And the power of relevance today, exactly. Yeah. Rich, so one observer in the documentary calls the clash between the police and the black community a, quote, unseen war. And it's been reported that $11 million was reportedly spent on law enforcement connected to the Ferguson uprising. Do you think the film is successful in showing how aggressive the policing is?
I think it really does. I mean, on the one side, it shows how these people just come to the streets just saying, how can you shoot an unarmed teenager 10 times? How can the police do this and then try to pretend like it's not an issue? And then the police respond to them coming out into the streets with, I mean, what you saw in the clip was, you know, they're all standing in a line looking really menacing. But later on, they come out with full riot gear and dogs and, you know, snipers on the tops of these giant tanks that are rolling into the streets. It's pretty terrifying because the police just reacted as if the public, who are just desperately crying out saying, don't treat us like this. The police are reacting as if they're the villains. The general public are the villains. And the film really captures that sense that these people just feel desperate and they don't really have a choice but to riot. Mm-hmm. They start off with a quiet vigil. It's a candlelight vigil. And their voices get louder and louder and louder because nobody's listening to them. And the police are responding like that.
As it said in the film also that Martin Luther King is quoted as saying the riots is the way, an act of showing the protest of the unheard. Now, Lee, what do you think of the militarization of the police? Is this an appropriate response to deal with the situation?
Well, it's not in a liberal democracy in supposedly, you know, the land of the free. I think what we're seeing all over the world, really, in Western democracies, is increasing militarization. And in fact, most Western police services are almost following a sort of Israeli policing model. That seems to be the standard model, to be very heavily militarized and to have the option of using overwhelming and overpowering force. The policing that we saw in Ferguson was akin to an invasion by a small army of a foreign occupying force seeking to invade another country. The combatants' language was the same, the imagery was the same, and I think it's a very dangerous precedent when the police force, and that's what it is, a force, can militarize itself using the advanced latest equipment available to them of any military in the world for use against civilians.
Mm. And it's exactly the point that you raised that, actually, because in the film we see an American Palestinian resident of Ferguson, and he used to live in the West Bank, and he said it's no different, the West Bank and Ferguson, in the way they're being treated. Do you think that's a fair point to make?
I think it is a fair point. I think if you look at the administration and dispensation of justice on the West Bank, Gaza, and you begin to look at Ferguson and other areas of the United States, you can see that an apartheid level of justice is being dispensed both in West Bank and in America. And to that extent, Israel and America share a similar approach to tackling minority groups that they dislike intensely, and that is to oppress and police them out of oblivion, really.
I want to talk quickly just how the police are portrayed in this documentary. We see the police officers wearing, some of them wearing bracelets for support for Darren Wilson, who shot Michael Brown. What did you make of this?
Well, I like the fact that they let them speak. It's not a purely one-sided documentary. It does kind of let people speak, but then the things the police said in reaction to this event and to the escalating violence were just all wrong. You know, they basically vilified Mike Brown. They showed, you know, a clip of him stealing something from a shop to say, oh, he was a hardened criminal. Well, it still doesn't mean that you can shoot him 10 times when he's unarmed in the back. I mean, that's crazy. The way that they spun the story and all of their press conferences and even the comments that they make to the cameras.
That they play the victim.
They play the victim. Themselves. And they act like they're the ones who are being attacked. And it's quite frightening, actually.
Sorry, Lee, you wanted to quickly add something?
I think what it also hints to is the vast chasm of perceptions between sections of white America and sections of black America about the nature, scale of racism. And what it means. And I think there's a conversation there that is being conducted through megaphones around a awfully complex and nuanced issue that is reflected in the total lack of understanding, I think, from white America about the reality of racism as it affects African Americans, Latinos, African Muslims, and so on and so forth in the USA. And
I don't think it's all of white America. I think there's a segment of white America that is just ignorant of the whole thing. There's quite a large segment that is aware of what's going on and is fighting.
I think I would agree with you, but I would say that racial inequality.
We did see a lot of white people in the crowd in support of the Black Lives Matter.
No, absolutely, and I think that's right. But I think that when you look at it over the course of history, that what you find is, despite whites having some theoretical acknowledgement of the existence of racism, racial inequality in America and the UK has gotten worse. Over every single measure. And so a rhetorical, understanding of racism and a practical and a theoretical understanding that gives you the tools to deal with it are two separate things.
Okay, great points there. We'll continue this, just taking a break now.
This was actually the first camera that I got when I first started cop watching. I just put my stickers on it, you know, put a picture on my camera so when the police looking, they could see that cop wash stick on there. Got some walkie-talkies. This is two of them for me. So when I leave, I get one of my wife. So the cops don't come in Canfield, like, no more, like, doing none of that crap. They do stranger stuff. And that's because we done changed. We made them change what they doing. That's all I want. You know, don't give them an opportunity to gun somebody down in the street. Be out there to watch them. I don't go out with no weapons or nothing like that. I go out with my camera, that's my weapon, you know? And the fact is that since the police are not being held accountable, we have to hold them accountable.
So David there with the Cop Watch Initiative. It's quite an endearing and inspirational character. Rich, what did you make of his story and progression?
I enjoyed his story. I like the fact that he's taking a positive approach to it. He's doing something that's really important, and the footage he's capturing is invaluable in making sure that everyone understands what's really going on.
And Lee, what do you make of these sorts of initiatives? Do you think social media helps in the struggle for racial justice?
Incredibly. I think they've made a huge difference, actually, to the optics and the understanding of the reality of racism. And of course, what we saw as a consequence of that type of activism is years later, you know, in-depth studies that showed the Ferguson police force were operating a sort of income-driven arrest policy that targeted poor blacks. And they were almost financially incentivized to racially profile that community. And I think that the cameras and the people and social media and access to it allows our community to get its voice heard.
And Rich, we also see, speaking of cameras actually, we see the coverage of how the hostility of the black community to the mainstream media in this documentary. Yeah. Why do you think they were so hostile?
Well, because the mainstream media covered this as an incident of looting. You know, they didn't cover it as a policeman killed an unarmed teenager. They covered it as, you know, residents of Ferguson are looting their local shops. they covered the wrong story.
Lee, I just wanted to get your thoughts on this. What do you think of the mainstream media coverage of sort of these movements, Black Lives Matter and police brutality?
I think we saw the same at the Grenfell Tower fire disaster post there, where the mainstream media descended on a community and they were very hostile to them. And I think it's largely because there are so few black and ethnic minority peoples in British newsrooms and US newsrooms. And even where they are there, the narrative seems to be overwhelmingly one of a sort of establishment elite perspective. New technology and these films give us an absolute way of breaking through that monitorium of silence that we've had for so long and allows these fresh voices for justice to percolate into the public consciousness. So I think it's an incredibly exciting time. And the internet may well be the thing that holds policing to account to a greater extent than anything else we've ever done.
So that's there's hope in the battle ahead then. That's great. So we're just going to take
as long as it's filmed
now from a discussion.
Good evening. My name is Bernie Fraser, and like all of you all, I'm a Ferguson resident. There are a lot of people in Ferguson who have become very fearful of living in this community. But I would like to help you understand one thing. There are many people who have only been fearful for 2 months. There are more people who have been fearful for 2 decades.
We're not dogs, we're not criminals, we're human beings. We bleed just like you do, we breathe just like you do. We wake up and go to work and punch the clock just like you do. Give us what we deserve. How can we respect the red, white, and blue when every time we see red, white, and blue, we being harassed, killed, assaulted, or our lives ruined?
I think it must have been very awkward for the black police officer to be in that situation, probably felt feeling very conflicted. I just want to read a statistic about US deaths by police gunfire. And by the Washington Post, it reported that at least 1,000 people were killed in 2017, and it's on track to reach that level. Lee, why do you think the issue of police brutality is such a big problem in the US?
I think largely because of the failure of US justice system to deliver, you know, equitable justice for people who suffered from grievous police assault and brutality. There's been systematic cover-up of those sorts of abuses. We've seen that year after year. 1,000 people dying in 2017, those are the numbers you expect in a small war, somewhere very distant. And it shows the extent to which the process of Jim Crow policing, and that's what it is, it's a Jim Crow-style policing without all of the formality of policy and legislation, but producing equally iniquitous outcomes, is the reality for most black experiences in America. Two-tier justice, apartheid levels of administration of justice, and a gross denial of the reality of racism that just angers and inflames disadvantaged communities.
And in the documentary, we see various references to President Obama at the time, and we get the sense of the frustration that the residents were powerless, even with a black president, that they couldn't get their justice. What did you make of this?
Well, I mean, they say he's not a black president, which is very telling. It's a very telling thing for them to say, because they feel like he's not sticking up for them. I'm not sure how much power he has to intervene in a local clash like that. And he did initiate an investigation into it, which did result in the finding that that police force was systemically racist. Mm-hmm. But then every investigation into every police force in America has come up with that same in every city all over the entire country, from Los Angeles to, you know, I mean everywhere. Mm-hmm. So it's a problem in the entire nation. And I think you know, like you were saying, It's a nation that's never really dealt with slavery.
Absolutely.
They made it illegal 150 years ago, and then they never really got rid of it.
That's right.
And they've just changed it into a system of, oppressive policing and marginalization, and it's it, it's, you know, it's that system that's carried on. And
it seems that we're now, we're,
people are just now saying, we're not going to put up with this anymore.
And then fast forward to today's president, we have Donald Trump, who has been criticized for encouraging police brutality, saying that the police are being too nice. What do you think of Trump's role, Lee, in race relations and police brutality?
Well, Trump is the original white Anglo-Saxon Protestant white privileged man in chief. He uses the bully boy pulpit in Charlottesville. He backed the fascists. He seemed completely unapologetic for the murder of an anti-fascist demonstrator by fascists in that area. He subsequently made his views known in relation to Muslims and African Americans. I mean, there can be no doubt. There are lots of people saying, oh, well, maybe Donald will mature with age or somehow become more nuanced by the politics of Washington. He's become more extreme, more discriminatory, and in fact encapsulates the very worst aspects of a sort of white supremacist, male, bigoted patriarchy that has somehow, through the dint of wealth and corruption, found its way to the top job in the United States. It's a disgrace for the country, it's a threat to the world, and it is emboldening and enlivening fascists and racists all over the world. So when Donald comes to the United Kingdom, I expect the whole of the European alt-right to turn out to counter any demonstrations we much put out. That's how dangerous this man is in the world.
I'm afraid we'll have to end on that powerful note, Lee. Thank you to both my guests and to you. Don't forget to leave your comments and your thoughts. I've been Camilla Shambiati.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayed Al Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma, Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. I think by now you've come to understand that Islam does have a lot to say as far as the economical side of a society is concerned. And the most important thing is that a Muslim must always remember the sensitivity of financial distribution. What do I mean by sensitivity of financial distribution? When it does come to you being an ultra-rich person, you need to take care of those who are underprivileged. And when you are a poor person, you know your position in life as well. As a poor person, you always need to have that sense of self-dignity and honor and know that you're going through a tribulation and a trial. And if you are a rich person, an affluent person, you also need to remember that you are going through a tribulation and a trial. Being poor or being rich are both ibtila'at from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But the difference here is, as Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi says, al-faqru fakhri, that I'm honored to be someone who is from the underprivileged. And he always acted in that way as well. You know, even though Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam had Baytul Mal opened up for them, but the way they conducted themselves was always being not only in that level of middle range, but below middle range. So people who were on that level would be able to relate to the Ma'sumeen. And our ulama live exactly the same kind of lifestyle. You know, you read the history, the biography of our ulama, you can see how much financial restraints they lived in. How they would, their months would go and they wouldn't even see a piece of meat. But at the same time, they had Baytul Mal right there in front of them. And they would deprive themselves of it and also their family members and say, I'm going to be responsible for every cent that I spend on Judgment Day. Do we, as you know, who haven't got to that stage of being maraj at taqleed and things like that, and having the large access to Baytul Mal and things, do we also need to follow in these? Of course we do. Of course. Extravagance is haram. Wasting is haram. Greed is haram. All of these things are continuous reminders and shock treatments for us to remember that there is a more important thing that we need to do, and that's making sure that we have that fairness as far as distribution of wealth is concerned. And that's what Islam emphasizes on. You know, the higher you go financially, the more responsible you will be for taking care of others.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatih Al Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih Al Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
There are many lessons
of the book
by those prophets. And
eat, take some in your hand, and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Why is it, unfortunately, that they say, like, I'm not precise in the statistics that I'm mentioning, but from the top of my mind, I remember something like up to 80% of the world's wealth is owned by 2% of the world, something like that. You know, it's just unbelievable kind of statistics where, you know, there are people who earn millions a day, millions an a day, millions an hour, and there are other people who live off a dollar a day, hand to mouth, surviving on the brink of death, you know, when it comes to hunger. Where is that fairness in these kind of societies? And I think it all comes down to greed and tamah. A person, you know, always wants more and more and more. And of course, dhulm as well, oppression. You know, why are you, you know, entitled to own something that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given to everyone, like minerals? You know, why can you mine and mine and mine as much as you have and avoid taxes and avoid all of these other things and, you know, allow these people to suffer financially because of your greed? And I think that's why Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli mentions the importance of the distribution of money, the distribution of wealth. When you look at in the Islamic system, Islamic economic system, you can see, for example, when it comes to treasures, when it comes to coins, when it comes to cattle, when it comes to, for example, grain and farming products, yields and things like that, there is a system put in place where, yes, you're able to expand, you're able to buy what you wish, you're able to live your life comfortably as well. But at the same time, you have an obligation towards those who are around you. And that's a beautiful thing. You know, that gives us that insaniya that we need, that gives us that level of staying humane and caring for others and having compassion, financial compassion for others. And we've mentioned this ayah before, I'll mention again. The Quran says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Len, you will never, Len tanalul birr hatta tunfiqu mimma tuhibbun. You will never attain righteousness until you give away that which you love the most. And that is, of course, money. And that's why the most difficult thing for us to do is give away money. And that's why, unfortunately, shaitan manipulates us in saying, well, no, it's not wajib for you. Why do you have to give money to someone else? What is that entitlement that someone else has for you? You did the work, you did your studies, you sweating because of all of the effort that you're putting in working, and then all of a sudden you need to go off and give it to someone, some random person that you don't even know. Of course, this is shaitan talking to us. And of course, when it comes to money, we love that the most, and that's why we want to cling onto it more than anything else. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.